From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, House Speaker Paul Ryan called on Republican Greg Gianforte to apologize after Gianforte was charged with assaulting a reporter. But Ryan sidestepped questions about whether Gianforte should withdraw from today's race for an open congressional seat in Montana.
The choice will be made by the people of Montana. I do not think this is acceptable behavior, but the choice will be made by the people of Montana.
According to Fox News reporter Alicia Acuna, yesterday, Guardian reporter Ben Jacobs walked into a room where she was preparing to interview Greg Gianforte, and Jacobs asked Gianforte a question about the Republican health care plan. Gianforte declined to answer, then grabbed Jacobs by the neck and threw him to the ground. Here's sound.
I'm sick and tired of you guys. The last guy that came in here, you did the same thing. Get the hell out of here. Get the hell out of here. The last guy did the same thing. You were the Guardian?
Yes, and you just broke my glasses.
The last guy did the same damn thing.
You just body slammed me and broke my glasses.
In a statement, Gianforte blamed aggressive behavior from a liberal journalist, but three Montana newspapers have now rescinded their endorsements of him. One is the Billings Gazette. Editor Daryl Ehrlich joins us by Skype. And Daryl, you begin your editorial saying we're at a loss for words, but you remind us Montana is a huge early voting state and one in which people now can't change their early vote. So do you now regret steering voters to Gianforte with your original endorsement?
It's a great question. I think that the timing is really important to get here. We always try to put our editorial out far enough in advance so that it's part of the conversation, but not meant to be the deciding factor. We base it on the interviews that we have on the time and what we know at that moment. And so I think it would be irresponsible of me to suggest that our editorial or the words that we write, whether it's on the opinion page or on our news pages, don't matter, because I believe they do. But I also believe that people who are worried that we steered folks toward him, I just don't believe that there's any way that we could have telepathically seen into the future and guessed anything like this.
Well, at the very least, in hindsight, and first of all, you do say you believe Gianforte should be allowed due process, which is going to be happening.
Yep.
But he possibly, didn't present himself appropriately because you write, we believe you cannot love America, love the Constitution, talk about the importance of a free press, and then pummel a reporter.
He broke that trust. We did take him at his word, and we said, I think in the original endorsement editorial, which we've got up online, people can read, is that we are going to trust him because we had very serious reservations about some of his espoused beliefs, whether they were on evolution, health care, climate change. We had deep disagreements with him on those and on gun rights. So there were some deep divisions, but we said we were taking him at his word for what he was going to, that he would listen to Montanans and really try to bring people together. We took him at his word because of that, and we're rescinding our endorsement because he broke that.
Yeah. Well, by the way, do you think that this is a climate that was prepared for someone like a Gianforte by another Republican who ran, President Trump?
Well, it's interesting because when Gianforte, it's interesting to know that Gianforte lost his bid for governor just in November. He ran against Democrat Steve Bullock, and nary a word was spoken about Trump then. Since then, the Greg Gianforte as a House candidate has used Trump at every moment, including having two separate visits in the state by Donald Trump Jr. and one by Mike Pence. I think there's no doubt that he's aligning himself much closer with the Trump administration. And I think everybody should be concerned with the way the media has been characterized by the Republicans. And because I think when you start saying things like enemy of the press or that the press are just bad people, making blanket statements like that or using, again, the word enemy comes to mind, I would say that's pretty dangerous language because people are allowed to go after their enemies.
By the way, I'm sure there are some supporters of Greg Gianforte who are cheering him because of the climate, the attitude about reporters right now.
Yeah, you can find it on our Facebook pages. People disappointed that we then rescinded, saying that we've kowtowed or we've somehow orchestrated or engineered this. That this is part of the liberal media plot or script. Absolutely not true. But there are some people who are saying, good, it's time to stand up to reporters. And that's obviously very concerning. I think it's great to push back on reporters' questions. I don't think it's good to push back on the reporters.
Daryl Ehrlich, editor of the Billings Gazette today. They pulled their endorsement of the Republican candidate for the congressional seat there, Greg Gianforte. Daryl, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, police investigating the suicide bombing in Manchester, England, have stopped sharing information with the U.S. after leaks to the media. There were photos in the New York Times today that showed debris from the attack, which apparently outraged British police. President Trump issued a statement today calling the leaks deeply troubling and asking the Justice Department to launch a review. Joining us now is the BBC's defense and diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus. He's in London. Jonathan, how angry are British officials about these leaks?
I think they're angry and extremely irritated. It's not just one leak. There's been a whole series of leaks to different media organizations, in some cases online sites, in some cases TV stations, and of course the crime scene pictures leaked to the New York Times newspaper. I think there are certainly police sources who believe that this could have had a material impact on the pace of their investigations. And of course, you've also got to remember that it's a very different information and media culture in Britain. This type of material tends not to be released until much later, once an investigation has largely been completed.
Is this likely to affect Britain's relationship with the US overall?
Well, I think in the long term, probably not. I think in the short term, yes. I think it's already a slightly sensitive relationship because people are still, of course, beginning to get used to Mr. Trump. He's not really like most presidents the British government have had to deal with in the past. I think there's also a concern that, of course, remember, it isn't intelligence sharing across the board that's been halted. It's specifically information relating to the ongoing investigation in Manchester. And this is information that is, if you like, shared between professionals on a routine basis, not least because if, for example, there were a similar incident, God forbid, in France or in Germany, then clearly security forces and the police would have up-to-the-minute information about aspects of the attack in Britain. So it's important that this information is shared, but very unusual that it should come into the public domain at this stage. And of course, what was interesting about President Trump's comment is that his response is situated, if you like, in the wider problems that, of course, he himself has had, in his view, with the U.S. intelligence services, right, when he spoke about these links having gone on for a very long time and his administration was going to get to the bottom of it. That's a rather different story, I think, from the very specific concerns that have been raised in Britain.
Well, let's talk about the investigation. Right now, there are at least 8 men in custody in connection with the bombing in Manchester. Is there a clear picture emerging of who the bomber was and whether he had help carrying out this attack?
Yes, there is. It emerged very quickly, I think. First of all, the key thing, of course, was to identify him. That was achieved quite quickly. Then, of course, to find his associates and any network that might have been operating around him. And I think very quickly it was realized that the nature of this attack suggested very strongly that he was not a lone individual. This was not like the attack earlier in the year in Westminster, where a radicalized individual drove a vehicle into a crowd of people on Westminster Bridge and then stabbed a police officer outside the British Parliament. So I think that really gave the extraordinary sense of urgency, the need to try and draw into the net as many of this man's associates as possible, of course, fundamentally and hopefully to forestall any second attack. Now, the assumption is that the bomb maker was not the individual who died in this suicide explosion. So, of course, the assumption is that that bomb maker is still out there. But the bomber himself, obviously having had links certainly to Libya and possibly to Syria, having flown into the country via Dusseldorf in Germany quite recently. So quite a considerable picture emerging. And I think certainly from what little information we glean from the intelligence services and the security services here, they seem reasonably pleased with the pace of the investigation and the leads that they are turning up.
The general election in the UK is 2 weeks from today. After the attack, the campaign was suspended. It has since resumed. How is all this going to play into the election?
Well, it's inevitably going to mean that security rises up the political agenda. It's interesting because the domestic intelligence service, MI5, has had more money over recent years. Police forces throughout the country generally have been having had their budgets cut. That's one of the reasons why the government has taken this very unusual step of deploying troops to guard key installations, key buildings in London, largely to free up, we're told, about 1,000 trained armed police officers who can then be put out in a more mobile, flexible role on the streets, of course, not just in London, but potentially in other major cities as well.
That's the BBC's defense and diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus, joining us from London. Jonathan, thank you.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
After Chris Cornell, lead singer of Soundgarden, was found dead of an apparent suicide last week, his wife Vicky released a statement saying the family believed the anti-anxiety drug Ativan may have pushed him to take his life. We've been hearing for years that there is a link between some prescription medication and an increased risk of suicide. A headline from Britain's Telegraph in 2016 reads, "Antidepressants can raise the risk of suicide." Here's a 2008 New York Times article detailing how antidepressants may cause some teens to become suicidal. Before that, the FDA put a black box warning about the possible links on some medications. Well, one of the researchers quoted in that Times piece was Dr. Kelly Posner-Gerstenhaber, a clinical psychologist and founder of the Columbia Lighthouse Project at Columbia University, where she created the well-known Columbia Suicide Severity Rating Scale. And she says, what? Dr. Gerstenhaber, was there a misunderstanding? There is no link?
You know, the fact is, Robin, if you look at the whole evidence puzzle from all over the world, it points very clearly in one direction, that medications don't cause people to be suicidal. In fact, it's the underlying diseases like depression that actually leads to people dying by suicide.
So what happened? So why do we think this? Why do we have these headlines? And in fact, you're quoted in these articles as being someone who reviewed some of these medications when it came to kids and teenagers. And that caused the FDA to see that there was a risk. What happened?
Yes, well, actually, I led the team that was commissioned by the FDA when they first had this critical question about whether medications cause people to be suicidal. So we worked very hard to give them interpretable data. But what we realized and the FDA realized very quickly is that the studies they were dealing with were not actually set up to give them the answers they needed, meaning, is there a causal relationship? And the very good news is that, and you know, the FDA always has to take the most conservative, worst-case approach. So we were dealing with very limited information. But as soon as they realized that they didn't have the right science to answer the questions, they then asked every study going forward to have the right science, which happens to be work that we're involved with as well. And that data tells us exactly what all the other science has told us, that medications do not cause people to be suicidal. It is the underlying diseases that actually do. And the data has been very clear. You know, since we have modern antidepressants like SSRIs, Paxil, Prozac, etc., the suicide rate has dropped dramatically across the world, across ages, reversing a trend prior to their introduction.
In fact, you say that after these reports came out, and I'm reading a line from the New York Times 2008, some drugs cause depression so often that doctors prescribed antidepressants prophylactically to go with them. I mean, that's, you know, that would be the takeaway for me from that article. And you say that these kinds of headlines at that time and this misunderstanding led to actually people cutting back on medications. And what happened to the suicide rate?
Yes, we were worried that we were in some horrible natural experiment because we know that they have helped prevent suicide. So when people started being afraid, the prescription rates started to plummet. And guess what? Suicide rates went up dramatically, not just in this country, but in other countries. And not only that, the diagnosis of depression plummeted to levels we hadn't seen in 10 years, because if you're, you know, somewhere and you can't treat, maybe you don't want to identify. So very terrible unintended consequences from these controversies and misunderstandings.
But what do you say to people who say, and again, a lot of this is anecdotal, a lot of it sadly is not. You know, they have the stories where they had a child or a teen who went on a drug and committed suicide. We know the very public headlines. Vince Foster, you know, there are tremendous, there are all sorts of conspiracy theories about how he died. But even those close to him who loved him, who don't believe the conspiracy theories, would say that he had just gone on an antidepressant when he committed suicide. The thinking again was that it pushed him over.
Yes, and understandable. But what we know, what the science tells us, and what common sense tells us is that when is somebody going to seek treatment? When they're most ill, when they're most depressed and most at risk for being suicidal. So the science shows us that the time of greatest risk is the month before starting treatment, and it declines steadily after treatment begins. And if you compare it to psychotherapy, it's exactly the same pattern. What that means, Robin, is that what is causing the risk is the medication not having a chance to work yet. Mm. Yeah. And that's the profound, actually dangerous misunderstanding.
The fact that they have gotten to the point where they're willing to take the medication means that they are at their most depressed.
Yes. And the biggest contributing factor to suicide is depression, this heritable, treatable medical illness that we actually know what to do with. We also know that severe anxiety is one of the most strongest immediate suicide risk factors. So in this case that we're talking about with Chris Cornell, in the context of chronic depression, if there's an exacerbation of anxiety symptoms, in turn triggered by a stressful event like a concert, that relationship is known to result in a much higher risk of people trying to take their lives. Mm. Meaning that basically, as scientists, one of the most effective explanations we have for people being suicidal is this biological predisposition that makes a person vulnerable to reacting to stress with wanting to take their own life. Mm-hmm. So when I said dangerous misunderstanding, we have to clarify and not have these thoughts that discourage people from taking the very medications they need to save their lives. He was very open about years of struggling with depression. Mm-hmm. And all of the other pieces point in that same direction. So these are moments where we have to take this information and try to do better so we can save lives in the future or save more lives.
Just incredibly sad and still very confusing. We've also been reading reporting that some people can have paradoxical relations to medication, so that, you know, I can't take those drugs they give you at the dentist that apparently make some people happy. They make me profoundly sad.
Of course, there are medications that have adverse side effects, right? Some medications can make you feel agitated or jittery. But the fact is, these medications that we're talking about do not cause people to be suicidal. And that is the most important message. These are the life-saving medications that people need to treat the psychiatric disorders that do cause people to die. Interestingly, you know, we've been talking about all these misunderstandings, and there was reporting errors. So in the FDA, in the limited science that we had to work with the FDA, there was not one suicide. No suicides. And you read headlines about causing suicide. You know, misunderstandings like that can have profound negative public health consequences. But it wasn't just these medications. There were lots of stories about, you know, Chantix was one of them. Mm-hmm. Chantix is by far the most effective smoking cessation drug in the world. Smoking kills 1 in 5 people. And from a case where a musician shot a neighbor while trespassing, somebody was just on the medication out there in the world, we had some of these similar things, prescription rates plummeting. But the good news, okay, the FDA asked for good data, the Columbia Suicide Severity Rating Scale. Fast forward to today, the Pfizer presented that data and they voted to remove a black box for the first time. Science conquering misunderstanding, which is again the good news.
But what do we do with a 2016 report from a legitimate organization in Britain? This is the Nordic Cochrane Center, which reviewed 70 clinical trials of some of the most common antidepressants and found they doubled the risk of suicide and aggressive behavior in people under 18. These results were analyzed by the University College London, endorsed in the British Medical Journal. You know, is it just that they're not seeing that the underlying disease is what caused the suicide, and maybe the drugs hadn't had a chance to take effect yet?
It's the way they're looking at one limited set of data. When you look at the whole world of data, you know, I started to talk about some of it, but all over the world, Japan was the latest one in 1999, where since they have antidepressants, they have lower suicide rates. In all over this country, counties with more antidepressant prescriptions associated with lower suicide rates, beautiful science controlling for every other factor that might lead to something else accounting for that, like access to mental health care. Many, many countless studies, a huge, huge body of evidence showing exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. What about another thinking that may also be a myth, that the reason that people maybe might take their lives right when they've started taking medication is that the medication, you know, gives them a sense of clarity, you know, maybe lifts some of the fog so that they're able to do it, horribly, but so that they're able to do it.
Energizes them. That's been one of the most profound misunderstandings. We trace that back to a line in a 1960s textbook. But what does the science actually tell us? The time of when somebody's going to seek treatment is when they're most depressed, most at risk. So the time of greatest risk is the month before starting treatment. And then right after treatment starts, it declines steadily. And if you compare that pattern to psychotherapy, it's exactly the same thing, meaning that risk of suicide in the beginning is because the medication hasn't had a chance to work yet.
Or the psychotherapy, yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Dr. Kelly Posner-Gerstenhaber, a clinical psychologist at the Columbia Lighthouse Project, run out of Columbia University, where she led the development of the Columbia Suicide Severity Rating Scale. Dr. Gerstenhaber, I know this is going to raise a lot of questions for people, so I think you would probably say, call their doctors. Correct, if they have one.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. I'm grateful for the opportunity.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
OPEC ministers met today in Vienna and decided to continue the oil production cuts they announced last fall for another 9 months. In February, 10 other non-OPEC countries, including Russia and Mexico, also joined OPEC nations in reducing production in a bid to raise prices. Kurt Nickisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review, joins us now with more. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
And why did they decide to extend these production cuts?
Well, the two countries that led this negotiation were Saudi Arabia and Russia. Saudi Arabia is actually taking its state-owned oil company and making it private. It's going to do an IPO. Russia has an election coming up. Those are two countries that want to see stable oil prices. And essentially, they just wanted to hold the line and not have prices come down.
And why have prices been falling as they have for quite some time now?
Well, number one, it's because OPEC and some non-OPEC countries decided to flood the supply to try to hurt U.S. producers. They actually caused this to try to keep U.S. and Canadian oil producers from being able to bring so much oil into the market, but it hasn't really stopped it. And so now they're trying to bring it back up and just kind of keep it as stable as they can.
But this cut that we're talking about today is just 2% of overall oil production. Prices haven't risen since the cuts. In fact, they've fallen. Even today, oil prices fell because the market thought maybe OPEC would do more. Why didn't they do more? Cut it even more.
Yeah. Well, the problem they have, if they make prices go back up to $100 per barrel like they were just 3 years ago, then U.S. oil production goes crazy again. Canadian oil producers in the oil sands, they start producing a lot. The U.S. technology to bring oil out of shale has just completely upended the OPEC's control over the market. And that's just a fundamental change in the global oil market, and they have to contend with that now.
It's just becoming harder for them to control oil prices.
Right? Yeah, the leverage is gone, and so they're trying to keep the U.S. as marginalized as possible. But really, now the U.S. rivals Saudi Arabia and Russia as the world's largest oil producer.
Well, maybe it will be good news for people who are heading out on Memorial Day weekend because gas prices are not quite as high as they would be if oil prices were a lot higher.
Yeah, I think consumers can kind of expect prices to stay in the same range where they've been in the last year.
All right, well, what about the stock market? Today, off to a strong start on Wall Street with the S&P 500 and NASDAQ opening at record highs. What's going on in the markets?
Yeah, so the market's got some good news from some retailers, Best Buy, Sears, so some companies that you would kind of think in the digital economy wouldn't be doing very well or still holding doing well. Same store sales are up. So all this comes on top of kind of the larger market that has been up since President Trump took office, that, you know, people think that the Republicans are going to be able to let the, you know, unleash the economy, unleash jobs, and unleash business. And right now, so far, these companies seem to be performing.
Yeah, well, we had that drop in the market after there was fear that all of the controversy going on at the White House was going to stop Republicans from being able to pass their big tax cuts. But since then, the market has bounced right back.
We'll see what happens.
Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Thanks as always.
Sure thing.
President Trump has been meeting today with European Union and NATO leaders in Brussels, day 6 of 9 on an ambitious tour through the Middle East and Europe. But ambition is no stranger to presidential trips abroad. And we're going to take a look back now at the history of that with Brian Ballow and Ed Ayers, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome back.
Thanks very much.
Ed, take us back to the early days. Was it always expected that a president would make foreign trips?
Au contraire, as they might have said in early America. throughout the 19th century, it was not the expectation at all. And matter of fact, domestic travel was so bad that people weren't sure they should do that even.
Well, and it wasn't even easy to travel in those days, especially far away.
Well, yeah, but think about this. So George Washington takes the most extensive domestic travel of any president before the 20th century. And he decides that this whole new country is not going to hang together if people can't actually see the federal government, of which he's the only embodiment. So he travels to all 13 states. You can just imagine what kind of quagmire that the roads were then. It worked out. People were really worried that this was going to be seen as a monarchical procession, but instead he struck the domestic tone and people thought, okay, maybe this country does have a future.
So what was the first planned foreign trip made by a U.S. president?
I'm not going to cede that so easily because that's the early 20th century. I will go ahead and let Brian give you the answer, but I want to point out what a prologue there was to all that.
Yeah, we are arguing about that as you speak, Jeremy. But historians do agree that the first formal trip by a president to a foreign country was Teddy Roosevelt in 1906. And he went down to Panama by boat, of course, and he spent 3 days there. And you might say that he was checking on the American investment in the Panama Canal, kind of kicking the tires, if you will.
But there's disagreement about that, about whether that was the first trip?
Only on the part of Ed Ayers.
Well, I just want to tell you how close we came. Let me just evoke these two moments. Andrew Johnson's walking across the bridge at Niagara Falls and almost steps into Canada before he catches himself. And then William McKinley almost steps over into Mexico because he's right down there in Texas. Then he goes, oh, no, that would be wrong.
Hmm. Yeah, and I just have to say, Jeremy, I find that so cool. It's almost like there's this invisible fence. I mean, it was really wrong to go to a foreign country.
Yeah, I mean, what would be the point? I mean, if you're the president of the United States, you have work to do here. And so I think that the idea was that you were serving this country. You had no right to be dilly-dallying in places like Canada, Mexico, much less Europe.
All right, well, let's talk about one of the most famous trips abroad by a U.S. president, and that would be President Nixon's trip to China.
Well, that really was a game changer for American foreign policy. And it actually was so important that years later, people referred to, well, that would be like Nixon going to China. And what people meant by that is Richard Nixon was associated with conservative foreign policy, very anti-communist. And for a guy who was so tough on communism to go to the People's Republic of China and these scary communists. And we have to remember how afraid Americans were of the People's Republic of China in the 1960s and early 1970s when Nixon announced that he was going to go to the People's Republic of China in 1972. It just signaled a gigantic shift in foreign policy. And this really does underscore why more courageous presidents in the 20th century who ventured afar, why they did it, because it could signal a very important change in foreign policy.
Now, if you think back to 1962 and President Kennedy's visit to Berlin, these days, all you think of is "Ich bin ein Berliner," right? Which was not even the right thing to say. But what was the importance of that trip?
Well, apparently it meant I'm a German pastry,
right.
Not not one of you from Berlin. But that was so important, Jeremy, and it was almost the opposite of Nixon's trip to China. And it's another thing that presidents do when they travel. Far from a shift in foreign policy, Kennedy was signaling to West Germany, to France, to England, we are going to stand behind you in these really, really tense times. And you have to remember, East Germany and the Soviet Union supporting it had just built the Berlin Wall. And Kennedy went there to signal to the Western democracies that they had the support of the United States, and the president himself was going to go to Berlin to underscore that.
I realize I'm going back in time here as we go through some of these examples, but let's continue on that journey and talk about FDR's trip to Yalta in 1945.
Well, you've just touched on another reason that 20th century presidents traveled. Roosevelt was going there to meet with his key allies, with Churchill, with Stalin, to really map out what the world order was going to look like after World War II came to a close.
Brian, isn't that what we imagine that foreign travel should be like, that would have a real concrete purpose and great photo ops?
I think that often it's just one or the other. I think this was less about photo ops and much more about real purpose. Of course, the irony, Ed, is the purpose became so disputed in the post-World War II world. What did Roosevelt really say? Did he really signal to Stalin, wink, wink, nod, nod, it's okay if you exercise control in Eastern Europe? Americans have battled over that for 20 or 30 years afterwards. But certainly at the time, going there to work out with allies what the world order was going to look like. This is, of course, what Woodrow Wilson thought he was doing when he went to Paris and Versailles for the peace conference that concluded World War I. Again, Wilson thought that this was a great moment for the United States to help shape the world order. In fact, the whole incident ended in a tremendous political defeat for Woodrow Wilson when his own U.S. Senate rejected that treaty years later.
Hmm. Has it always been the sort of unwritten rule when the president is out of the country that his political enemies in the U.S. are not supposed to say anything bad about him?
Well, that's one of the reasons that there were such reluctance to travel in the first place, because not only do you worry about what your enemies might say, but you wonder about what your allies might do. Mm. Who's actually running the show back there? We don't really have a very strong structure for the distribution of power when people left office. And so there was a lot of concern that, oh, gosh, who's in charge here now? What George Washington is traipsing up and down the North American continent. So I think it creates all kinds of anxieties on all kinds of fronts.
Now, let's talk about flubs abroad, and I think back to George H.W. Bush vomiting on the Japanese prime minister.
Are we allowed to say that on public radio, Jeremy?
I think so. I just did.
Well, what I will say is that, in fact, President Bush had been feeling nauseated for the whole day, and one could really give him a lot of credit for just showing up at this dinner. But if we're going to hand out credit in an unfortunate situation, it is true that he vomited, in essence, into the lap of the Japanese prime minister. But if we're going to hand out medals, we got to give one to Barbara Bush. I was just watching this video the other day, Jeremy. It's just amazing. She grabs a napkin. She runs over. She puts it over the president's mouth. She ducks his head below the table so it's not as graphic as you might think. And then she just, you know, with great presence of mind, walks back and sits down at her place. Then all hell breaks loose. The Secret Service guys are jumping over tables, et cetera, et cetera. But there you go. I mean, these are some of the dangers of non-controlled situations.
When did foreign leaders start coming to the U.S.?
That was much earlier. The big one is Marquis de Lafayette, 1824, the great French hero of the American Revolution. And like Washington, despite the terrible travel, covered the entire United States. And everywhere he went, he was paraded and banqueted and celebrated. So that was a big deal. But it's not again until after the Civil War when the King of Hawaii is brought to visit President Grant. So that, too, is very spotty. We don't really see much of a trend until suddenly it seems the United States enters the world in the 20th century.
That's Ed Ayers and Brian Ballow, historians and co-hosts of the podcast Backstory. Guys, thanks so much.
Bon voyage.
And this note, today a congressional committee unveiled draft legislation that would repeal the federal prohibition on sports betting and allow states to legalize online gambling. The Gambling Accountability and Modernization Enhancement Act, or GAME Act, released by the House Energy and Commerce Committee, gives oversight authority over betting to the Federal Trade Commission and outlines the consumer protections states would need to have in place in order to offer legal sports betting. Sports betting is legal in just a handful of states, including Nevada. Delaware, Nevada, and New Jersey are the only states that allow online gambling. But legislation is advancing in Pennsylvania to legalize online gambling as well. Well, here in the States, people bet on sports hoping to make a little money or maybe a big win. But in the developing world, where people are not able to borrow money to finance buying a house or land or even a computer, there's growing evidence they're turning to gambling to get money for those big purchases. Let's get that story from Sonia Paul in Kampala, Uganda.
Legal sports betting in the African country of Uganda is booming. Just ask any representative from the country's National Lotteries Board. Tax revenue from the gambling industry has shot up by more than 4,500% since 2003. And the reasons why are apparent on most busy streets here in Kampala. Take Kabalagala. It's a bustling neighborhood sometimes referred to as Uganda's Las Vegas. And 26-year-old Elias Eruket is ducking in and out of the sports betting shops dotting its sidewalks. On just one stretch of road less than a mile long, there are 17 of them.
I finished doing my accounting course. I never got a job. I had interest in football. I got a job in sports betting. That was in 2012.
A big win on a sports bet inspired Eruket to get a job in the gambling industry. Today, he's a betting company's public relations officer. But he still gambles.
I'm not so ambitious that I'll build a big house from betting, or I'll buy land, or I'll make a shop from betting. No, I just get that money just to clear up some small things, and I'd be like that.
Build a house? Buy land? It may sound pretty far-fetched. Something better fit for, say, taking out a loan at a bank. But most Ugandans can't get those kinds of loans, so they turn to betting for a chance at a better life. Inside one of the sports betting shops here, a local radio station rings out from a speaker. A few men seated on plastic chairs stare intently at the muted soccer matches playing on two flat-screen TVs. Others chat while standing in line to place their bets. It's not a big game day. About 10 guys are hanging out. But for those with big bets on the games, the mood is intense and focused. Back on the street, Eruket says these customers are mostly casual laborers who earn by the day. They don't have credit cards. Small loans are impossible for most of these guys.
Now when they are off duty, they come and be in the shop. But I heard that some people sell what they have to start betting.
For people like Joshua Shkule, who is the Secretary General of the Interreligious Council of Uganda, this is incredibly frustrating.
This time they spend speaking and talking about sports, you can't imagine.
He says betting on soccer has been a disaster for Ugandans.
Instead of engaging themselves in things that are going to benefit their lives, they are in sports. And not even our Ugandan sports. They're talking about sports in Europe.
But economic researchers say it's not that simple. Something else is at play that's helping betting to flourish. Banks that don't serve working people. Sylvan Herskowitz researches development economics at UC Berkeley, specifically sports betting in Uganda. He says one reason betting is so popular is that it's difficult for most Ugandans to work with banks and build credit.
This is a setting where the cost of credit is high, and saving is really hard. I mean, it's hard anywhere, but I think it's particularly hard in a lot of these settings.
Many people who bet are seriously trying to win to afford items beyond their daily budgets, like household repairs, he says. Similar to scratch tickets in the U.S., you raise your chances of winning the more you bet, which is why some people bet more and more. They tend not to realize they're betting against an international odds market stacked against them.
And what it suggests to me is that we should focus on helping people to improve their ability to save, that we should focus on improving people's access to affordable credit. And by doing that, you can reduce the sort of more problematic part of people's participation in betting.
There's a worldwide effort to transform gambling habits into savings habits with a concept called prize-linked savings. Think of it as gamifying saving. You make a deposit into a savings account and enter the chance to win big. A U.S. app called The Long Game, for instance, syncs bank account deposits with automatic lottery tickets. But in Uganda, nothing like this exists. Instead, interest rates on credit cards range from 22 to 25%, according to the World Bank. And qualifying for a card is something most workers can't manage. Meanwhile, Elias Aroquet says the thrill for gambling remains unmatched. Anyone who dreams, he says, can understand this.
Betting is about hope, possibility, chances. Even life is about chances.
For Here and Now, I'm Sonia Paul, reporting from Kampala, Uganda.
And Sonia's story comes to us from the news app 60DB and the International Women's Media Foundation. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.